They left all their furniture and possessions in the cottage outside the stockade of the king's kraal, and they rode light, with a blanket roll on the pommel of the saddle and a food bag on one of the spare horses that Jan Sjoerd brought up behind on a lead rein. Louise rode like a man, astride and uncomplaining, and on the fifth day, unexpectedly, they came up with Jamieson's column in camp around the skeletal headgear of Iron Mine Mill, where the volunteers from Salisbury and Fort Victoria had joined up. Zuga, is that how Jamieson is going to challenge Lobengula's impi? The little encampment looked pathetically inadequate. There were 24 wagons, and on the canvas tents of most of them, Zuga could make out the insignia of Ralph's transport company. But he pointed to the corners of the laager. Machine guns, he said. 6 of them, and they are worth 500 men each. They have field guns also. Look at their emplacements. Oh, Zuga, do you have to go with them? You know that I do. They rode down into the camp, and as they passed the pickets, there was a hail that startled the sentries and made Louise's horse shy and skitter. Papa! Ralph came hurrying from the nearest wagon. My boy! Zuga jumped down from the saddle, and they embraced happily. I should have known you would be wherever there was something doing. Louise bent from the saddle, and Ralph brushed her cheek with his fine moustache. I still find it difficult to believe that I have a stepmother so young and beautiful. You are my favourite son, she laughed, but I'd love you more if you could arrange a hot bath. From behind the canvas screen, Louise kept calling for more buckets of hot water. And Zuga had to carry them from the fire and top up the galvanised hip bath in which she sat with her thick, dark braids piled on top of her head, glowing pinkly from the almost boiling water and taking full part in the conversation beyond the screen. Ralph and Zuga sat at a camp table with a blue enamel pot of coffee and a bottle of whiskey between them. We have 685 men in all. I warned Rhodes that he would need 1,500, Zuga frowned. Well, there are another 500 volunteers under Major Gould Adams, ready to move off from Maklutsi. Oh, they would never get here in time to take part in the fighting, Zuga shook his head. What about lines of supply and reinforcement? What happens if we get into trouble with the Matabele? What chance of a relieving force? Ralph grinned devilishly. I am the whole commissariat. You don't think I'd split the profits with anyone else, do you? Resupply? Relieving force? Ralph spread his hands in negation. The doctor informs me that we don't need them. God and Mr. Rhodes are on our side. If it goes against us, it will be death and mutilation for every man, woman and child this side of the Shashi River. Lobengula's impis are mad for war now. Neither the king nor his indunas will be able to control them once they begin. That thought had occurred to me, Ralph admitted. I have Kathy and Jonathan at Fort Victoria packed and ready. Old Izasi is with them, and one of my best young men. I have fresh relays of mules posted all the way from Fort Vicky to the Shashi. The hour Jamieson gives the word for the column to march, my family will be on their way south. Ralph, I am taking Louise to Fort Victoria. Can she stay with Kathy and leave with her? Nobody asked me, Louise called from behind the screen, and there was an angry splash of water. I took a vow, until death us do part, Zuga Ballantyne. You also vowed to love, honour and obey, Zuga reminded her and winked at Ralph. I hope you don't suffer the same insubordination from your wife. Beat them regularly and give them plenty of babies, Ralph advised. Of course, Louise must go with Katie, but you'd better leave for Fort Vicky right away. The doctor is champing at the bit to settle Lobengula's hash. He broke off and gestured as a trooper who was hurrying towards their wagon across the laager. And it looks as though he's heard of your arrival at last. The trooper saluted Zuga breathlessly. Are you Major Zuga Ballantyne, sir? Dr. Jamieson asks you please to come to his tent at your earliest convenience. Dr. Jamieson jumped up from the travelling desk and bustled across the tent to meet Zuga. Ballantyne, I was worried about you. Have you come directly from Lobengula? What are the chances? What force do you reckon he disposes? He broke off and scolded himself with a deprecatory chuckle. Oh, what am I thinking of? Let me get you a drink, man. He led Zuga into the tent. You know General St. John, of course. And Zuga stiffened, his face expressionless. Zugger? Mungo St. John lounged in a canvas camp chair. But he made no effort to rise or offer his hand. How long is it? But you are looking well. Marriage agrees with you. I have not had the opportunity to congratulate you. Thank you, Zugger nodded. Naturally, he had known that Mungo was the doctor's chief of staff, but still he was not ready for his anger and bitterness at the confrontation. This was the man who had kept Louise as a mistress, had held her tender, precious body. He found that he was trembling, and he thrust the picture from his mind, but it was replaced instantly by the image of Louise as he had found her in the desert, her skin burned off her in slabs by the sun. And it was Mungo St. John who had let her go and made no effort to follow her. I have heard that your wife is in camp with you. St. John's single eye glowed maliciously. You must dine with me tonight. It will be gratifying to discuss old times. My wife has had a long, hard journey, Zugger kept his voice level. He did not want to give Mungo the satisfaction of knowing how angry he was. And in the morning I am taking her into Fort Victoria. Good, Jamieson cut in briskly. That suits my own plans. I need a trustworthy man to put a message on the telegraph line for Mr. Rhodes. But now, Ballantyne, what is the news from Cabuluwayo, and how do you rate our chances? Well, Dr. Jim, Lobengula's ready for you. His young men are spoiling for a fight, and you have a scanty enough force here. In the ordinary way, I would say that to take it into Matabele land without reinforcements or a relieving force in the offing would be suicide. However, Jamieson demanded eagerly, four of Lobengula's regiments, those he sent against Lewanika, the king of the Barotse, are still on the Zambezi. And Lobengula will not be able to use them. Why not? Smallpox, Zuga said. It's broken out in those regiments, and he dare not recall them to the south. They can take no part in the fighting. Half the Matabele army out of it, Jamieson exulted. That's a nudge from on high, St. John. What do you think? I would say it's still a risk, a damnable risk. But think of the stake. A whole country to be won, with all its lands and herds and gold. I'd say if we are ever to march, we must march now. Ballantyne, your sister, the missionary woman, what's her name? Codrington. Is she still at Carmi? Is her family there with her? Zugo nodded, mystified, and Jamieson snatched up a pencil and scribbled a message on his pad. Then he tore off the sheet and handed it to Mungo St. John. Mungo read it and smiled. He looked like a bird of prey, beak-nosed and fierce. Yes, he said. Perfect. He passed the sheet to Zugger. Jamieson had written in block capitals. Urgent for Jove. Matabele regiments massed to attack. Stop. English women and children in the power of the Matabele tyrant. Stop. Imperative we march at once to save them. Reply soonest. Even Labouchere couldn't quibble with that, Zugger remarked wryly. Labouchere was the London editor of Truth magazine, a champion of the oppressed, and one of Rhodes's most eloquent and persistent adversaries. Zugger proffered the sheet, but Jamieson waved it back. Keep it. Send it. I don't suppose you could leave this evening? Jamieson asked wistfully. It'll be dark in an hour, and my wife is exhausted. Very well, Jamieson agreed. But you will return here as soon as you can with Mr. Rhodes's reply. Of course. And there'll be something else I want you to do on your return, a most important assignment. Oh, what is it? General St. John will explain. And Zuga turned suspiciously to Mungo. Mungo's manner was suddenly placatory. Zuga, there's not one of us who hasn't read your book, Hunter's Odyssey. I would say that it's the Bible of anybody wanting to know about this country and its people. Thank you. Zuga was unbending still. And one of the most interesting sections is the description of your visit to the oracle of the Amlimo in the hills south of Cabuluwayo. The Metopus, Zuga told him. Yes, of course, the Metopus. Could you find your way back to the witch's cavern? After all, it has been over 25 years. Yes, I could find it again. Zuga did not hesitate. Excellent, Jamieson interrupted. Come along, St. John. Do tell him why. But Mungo seemed to digress. You know the old Zulu who works for your son? Izasi, "Ralph's head driver?" Zuga asked. "That's the one. Well, we captured 4 Matabele scouts, and we put Izazi in the stockade with them. He can pass for a Matabele, so the prisoners spoke freely in front of him. One of the things we learnt is that the Amlimo has called all the witch doctors of the nation to a ritual in the hills." "Yes," Zuga agreed. "I heard of it before I left Kabulawaya. The Amlimo is preaching war and promises a charm to the impis that will turn our bullets to water." "Ah, so it's true then," Mungo nodded, and then thoughtfully, "just what influence does this prophetess have?" "Well, the Amlimo is a hereditary figure, a sort of virgin demi-deity that has her origins long before the arrival of the Matabele in this land, perhaps 1,000 years or more ago. First Mzilikazi and then Lobengula have fallen under her spell. I have even heard it whispered that Lobengula served an apprenticeship in sorcery under the Amlimo's guidance in the Metopus. Then she does wield power over the Matabele. Immense power. Lobengula makes no important decisions without her oracle. No impi would march without her charms to protect them. If she were to die on the day we march into Matabele land, it would throw the king and his warriors into consternation. They would probably act recklessly. The Amlimo's charms would perish with her. Her advice might turn like a serpent and strike the receiver. They would be demoralized, and it would take at least 3 months to choose a prophetess to replace her. During that time, the nation would be vulnerable. Zuga, I want you to take a party of mounted men, the toughest and the best we have. I want you to ride to the witch's cave and destroy her and all her witch doctors. Will Daniel was Zuga's sergeant. He was a Canadian who had been 20 years in Africa without losing his accent. He had fought the tribes on the Fish River and in Zululand. He boasted that he had killed 3 of Keshwayo's men with a single shot at Yulundi and made his tobacco pouch from the scalp of one of them. He had been in the Gazaland Rebellion and fought at the Hill of the Doves against the Freeburgers of the Transvaal Republic. Wherever there had been trouble and shooting, Will Daniel had forged his bloody reputation. He was a big man, heavy in the gut, prematurely bald, with large round ears that stood out from his polished scalp like those of a wild dog. His fists were gnarled, his legs bowed from the saddle, and he wore a perpetual wide white grin, which never touched his cold little eyes. "You don't have to like or trust him," Mungo St. John had advised Zuga, "but he is the man for the job." With Will Daniel went his henchman, Jim Thorne, half Will's size, but every bit as vicious, a skinny little cockney, with the grey tones of the slum dweller so deeply etched into his gaunt, melancholy face that 5,000 African sons had been unable to erase them. Dr. Jamieson had released him from the Fort Victoria jail, where he was waiting trial for beating a Mashona servant to death with a rhinoceros hide chambok. His pardon depended on his conduct during the campaign. "So you can rely on him to do whatever needs doing," Mungo had pointed out to Zuga. The other 13 troopers were men of similar type. They had all volunteered under Dr. Jim's Victoria Agreement and signed the enlistment document, a document which Jamieson made sure remained secret. No copy of it went to the High Commissioner in Cape Town, nor to Gladstone's government in Whitehall, for it promised the volunteers a share of Lobengula's land and cattle and treasures. The word loot was specifically mentioned in the text. On the first night out, Will Daniel had come silently to where Zuga slept, a little apart, and as he stooped over Zuga's recumbent form, a wiry arm had whipped suddenly around his neck, and the muzzle of a Webley revolver was thrust under his ribs with sufficient force to drive the air from his lungs. "Next time you creep up on me, I'll kill you," Zuga hissed into his face, and Will's teeth flashed in the moonlight as he grinned appreciatively.
"They told me you were a sharp one. What do you want?" "Me and the boys want to sell our land rights. 3,000 Morgan each. That's 90,000 acres. You can have them for 100 each."
"You haven't earned them yet."
"That's a chance you got to take, Skipper."
"I thought you were on guard duty, Sergeant."
"Well, it was just for a moment, sir.
Next time you leave your post, I'll shoot you myself, without bothering about a court-martial."
Daniel stared into his face for a moment.
"Yep, I reckon you would too,
Will grinned mirthlessly. Zuger led the patrol south and westwards through the forests where once long ago he had hunted the wandering herds of elephant. Now the tuskers were all gone, and even the herds of lesser game were wild from the unrestrained hunting of the new settlers, and they scattered at the first approach of the small party of horsemen. Zuger avoided the established roads between the Matabele regimental towns, and when they had to pass close to a settlement or the cultivated land surrounding it, they did so at night. Though he knew that the impis had all answered Lobengula's call and were already assembled at Tabas in Dunas, still he felt a vast relief when the granite domes of the Matopus rose above the treetops ahead of them, and in single file his horsemen followed him into one of the steep-sided valleys. That night there was a deputation of four troopers, led by Will Daniel and Jim Thorne.
"The boys have all voted, Skipper. We will take 100 for the lot," Will grinned ingratiatingly. "There's not one of us have the price of a drink to celebrate when we get home, and you have that money belt around your belly. It must be damned heavy by now, and no good it will do you if a Matabele sniper puts a bullet in your back."
The smile was still on Will's face, but the threat was naked in his eyes. If Zuger did not buy their land grants, it might be a bullet in the back. They would divide up the contents of his money belt anyway. Zuger considered defying the big ugly sergeant, but there were 15 of them. The gold in his belt could be his death warrant. He was in enough danger from the Matabele.
"I have 75 sovereigns in my belt," he said grimly. "Fine," Will agreed. "You got yourself a bargain, Major."
Zuger wrote out a contract of land grant sale on the back page of his message pad, and 12 of them signed it. Will Daniel and 2 other illiterates made their marks, and then they squabbled over the division of the gold sovereigns from Zuger's belt. Zuger was relieved to be rid of them, and as he returned the pad to his saddlebag, he realized abruptly that if those grants were valid, then Will Daniel was right. He had got a bargain. He decided that when he rejoined Jamison's column, he would buy up all the other grants that were on offer from any of the rootless drifters who wanted to sell for the price of a bottle of whiskey. Zuger had forgotten just how intense were the peculiar brooding silences of the magical Matopus Hills. The silence was a thing of weight and substance that made their spirits quail. No bird twittered or danced upon a twig in the dense undergrowth that pressed in upon the narrow path, and no breeze reached into the depths of the granite-sided valleys. The silence and the heat weighed even upon the hard and unsusceptible men who followed Zuger in single file. They rode with their rifles held across their laps, their eyes narrowed against the glare from the sparkling chips of mica in the granite walls, watchful and anxious, the dense dark green bush about them charged with a nameless menace. At times the narrow game trails they were following pinched out or ended abruptly in the gut of a valley, and they were forced to retrace their route and try another. But always Zuger kept working south and west. Then, on the third day, he was rewarded. He cut the broad beaten road that led from Gubulawayo to the hidden valley of the Amlimo. It was wide and smooth enough for Zuger to spur his horse into a canter. At Zuger's orders, his troopers had muffled their equipment and put leathers over the hooves of their mounts, so that the only sound was the creak of saddlery and the occasional brush and whip of an overhanging branch.